It is said that our energy system is in the midst of a major transition. Power sources are shifting from coal to more natural gas and renewables. Our aging grid needs to adapt, becoming smarter and more flexible and resilient. Recognizing that this transition has the potential to spark innovation in business and government, leading to new jobs and a cleaner environment, the University of Minnesota has launched a new project at the University of Minnesota Institute on the Environment. It's called the Energy Transition Lab, and its faculty director is Professor Hari Osofsky of the University of Minnesota Law School. As faculty director, Professor Osofsky brings a decade and a half of academic research, policy, project, leadership, and litigation experience to the Energy Transition Lab, and she is joining us now on the phone to explain more about energy transition. Professor Osofsky, welcome to the Roadhouse.
Thank you so much. It's such a pleasure to be able to talk with you this afternoon.
All right. Well, first of all, why don't you give us a brief description of what is this Energy Transition Lab that you are the faculty director of?
Of course. Well, as you mentioned, it's a joint project between the Institute on the Environment and the Office of the Vice President of Research housed in the law school. But basically, the idea behind the Energy Transition Lab, as you said, is that there's a lot of ways in which our energy system is in transition right now. And as a public university, you know, a public land-grant university, the University of Minnesota really has at its core of its mission, you know, trying to support the public good. And so the idea is that we will work collaboratively, you know, build interdisciplinary teams at the university that work collaboratively with leaders in government and business and nonprofits and the community more broadly to really try to move forward energy transition. We are focusing at different scales. So, you know, part of what we're doing is looking at the local scale, looking at energy transition in cities, in not only the Twin Cities region, but around Minnesota and also working with other cities around the country. We're also thinking at a state level about what this means, and then thinking nationally and internationally about these issues.
All right. How many people are involved in the lab itself besides you?
Well, the lab has three staff. I was really excited that we were able to recruit this summer as our inaugural executive director, Ellen Anderson, who served in the state legislature for 18 years, being an author of a lot of our renewable energy legislation in this state, and before chairing the Public Utility Commission and working as a senior advisor to the governor. So she serves as the executive director, and she and I collaborate a lot. And then we also have Aaron Sickink supporting the lab in administrative capacity, as well as a number of student research assistants. So that's kind of the staff piece of the lab. And then, you know, we're working with a lot of different organizations on the projects that we're doing. So faculty around the university are a collaborator, people around the state, country, and world.
I'd like to turn now to a list you prepared with Ellen Anderson, I believe, of top 10 key areas of energy transition, sort of as it's described here, a sort of a David Letterman top 10 list. Start with number 5, stop uh-huh. wasting energy.
Yeah.
And you're talking about our conventional systems wasting a lot of energy, and there are opportunities to improve that if we can overcome laws that hamper innovation. What laws are you talking about there?
Well, sure. So, there are a variety of different kinds of laws that that can serve as barriers, and then there are ways in which law isn't a barrier. So let me step back and just say for a minute that part of why a focus on energy waste is so important is this is one of these areas where there can be real win-wins between the economy and the environment, right? Because when we waste energy, it's not only bad environmentally, but it wastes money. And so There are all sorts of opportunities for cities and businesses to be more energy efficient and improve their bottom line at the same time. One of the projects that I worked on, that we worked on last spring in my Climate Change and Clean Energy Capstone, which is a jumping off point for some of our work on this, was we were looking at a Minnesota law that limits opportunities for cities to exceed sort of state standards on energy efficiency. So the state sets standards and provides limited exceptions in which cities can do more than that. And so one of the things that we looked at were sort of ways in which cities could innovate despite that, and also models around the country of states that had laws like ours and states that allowed cities to do more. And, you know, this is, by the way, a broader question that comes up not just between local and state government, but also between state and national government, right? Which is that when a larger level of government sets a standard, sometimes they sort of preempt action. They say, this is what you can do. And sometimes they set minimum standards and say, as long as you exceed our minimum standards, you're fine. And so
Give me an example of what standards of what?
So it's a question of what cities can require, you know, people say building in their city to do. So they might want to require them to have a certain level of energy efficiency, but they're limited by what the state allows.
Mm-hmm. Would this example be for new buildings or for existing buildings that had to be retrofitted in some way to be
right,
more efficient?
Right, for existing buildings, and it's a question of, you know, whether, you know, to what extent cities can try to make their existing stock more efficient.
Do we do that now?
Do we make them more efficient
do
now?
Do cities do that?
Yeah,
now?
So they're, you know, city. I mean, a lot of cities around the state and in the Twin Cities metros in particular are doing all sorts of, you know, innovative things to try to improve energy efficiency. And by the way, these can sometimes be, I mean, not just in buildings, but more broadly. So, for example, you know, if cities change the way they do lighting and light bulbs in their traffic lights, that can increase efficiency as well. So it can mean all sorts of different kinds of things.
Well, segueing into the next topic or the next item was number four on your list was create 21st century utility models. Mm-hmm. And again, I gather this also deals with waste or reliability or, you know, what kind of incentives or laws or regulations can you impose that will make our utility companies more 21st century? What do you mean by that?
So this connects into sort of a broader question, right? Which is, when you look at how utilities have traditionally done business around the country, including in Minnesota, right, the old model of how we do energy and the role of utilities in doing energy is you have some big power plant, right, some big source of energy, and then that is piped around to everyone, right, through the transmission lines, essentially. You know, so it's transmitted all over the grid. One of the models that the energy system has been moving towards is more decentralized energy, right? So instead of moving energy from big power plants, having more dispersed sources of energy, you know, and also, you know, ways of bringing more renewable energy online, that really changes sort of our traditional model of how utilities produce and distribute energy. Now, that's happening at the same time as technology around the grid is changing, right? So, you know, if you think about the electricity grid, there are places around the country where, you know, our grid is more than 50 years old. And, you know, we'd never tolerate a 50-year-old computer at our workplace. I mean, can you imagine? Right? I mean, you know, people are often refreshing their computers every 3 years or so. But so as we have to upgrade our aging transmission grid and electricity grid, there are all sorts of questions about how you, on the one hand, take advantage of technology that allows us to understand how energy is moving around, because as you computerize the grid, there's a lot of information that can help you do it better. But at the same time, addressing cybersecurity, making sure that people's privacy is protected. So converting our utility model is about all those different things that are transitioning. It's also about the transition we're making in sources, right?
Just to pick on, let's say, the little individual solar panel that somebody has on their home, or a city has at City Hall or something like that, and being able to input that product into the grid somehow.
Right, exactly.
That didn't used to be possible, as I understand it, and now it is.
Exactly.
Is that? Have we made utility companies do that, or did they choose to do that?
It's a combination of the two. I mean, I think that there's, as sort of distributed models of, so there are ways in which our laws have changed over time to try to encourage more decentralized generation. So one of the ways in which that's happened, for example, is, this sort of is a step up from the individual producer, but one of the problems once you make energy is how do you get it to people? And so one of the things that's happened legally over the years has been a forcing of companies to allow open access to their transmission line, that energy can move from place to place. Mm-hmm. It's partly a regulatory issue. It's partly a technological issue, right? Which
sure.
is in order to have somebody's solar count, there has to be something that can count it reliably.
We are speaking with Professor Hari Osofsky of the University of Minnesota Law School, who is the faculty director of the Energy Transition Lab, a newly introduced project of the University of Minnesota Institute on the Environment. And we're going through their top 10 list. We're not going to make it through the whole top 10 list, Professor Osofsky, but I'm on back up to number 2 now, talking about bringing renewable energy to scale. We've talked about solar and maybe a little less. We haven't really talked about wind, but those are the two that pop into my mind as the most readily available renewable energy source that we have. And how do you make those more affordable or more competitive?
Well, in fact, one of the most hopeful things I've heard in many years on energy transition is I take my students to go to MISO, which is the Mid-Continent System Operator. For people unfamiliar with it, it's sort of the company. It's not a company. It's the entity that basically moves all the it regulates the movement of electricity around our regional grid. So it literally is sitting there and working with utilities on how things move around and who's putting what onto the grid. If you're old enough to be like me and like that 1982 Matthew Broderick movie War Games, it looks a lot like that, sort of big screens where you see electricity moving around. Anyway, the reason I raised MISO is because, when I was talking to the system operator at MISO, he said to me, we get as much wind on the grid as possible because it's cheap, because it's the cheapest form of energy that we have. One of the things that's really exciting for Minnesota in particular is we have huge wind capacity in this state, and a growing wind energy as well as a growing solar industry. And so it actually is a really cheap and affordable form of energy, which then, makes energy cheaper for everyone as it's able to be brought on the grid more.
Then turning to number 9 on your list, you say make progress in a partisan political environment, which we're all very familiar with right now.
Yes.
And what are the challenges here, and what are your hopes?
Well, so I'm so excited that you asked me about this. I actually have an Australian co-author, Jackie Peel, at the University of Melbourne, who I've been working with on a new project on energy partisanship. And basically, we start from this premise, which is that people actually agree on a lot of things around energy issues. You just wouldn't know it because of the sort of vitriolic national dialogue that you hear on these issues, right? From the war on coal to the Flat Earth Society. And one of the things to me that's most exciting about the Energy Transition Lab is I think it provides us an opportunity to find places that people agree. I mean, one of the things that Jackie and I found in our research is the places where you get bipartisan agreement substantively, it tends to be around sort of things that have real economic benefit, issues of disaster resilience. But structurally, it's about, it can be, you know, about scaling down to the local, about involving corporations. And so these are all things that we're doing on the ground. We're, in fact, you know, we haven't talked about it yet, but we're doing some really exciting work around fostering local action on climate change that I think provides a wonderful opportunity, you know, to really make a difference in a way that, again, is not partisan. So I think it's about, you know, finding those win-wins.
Why not maybe take this opportunity, since you introduced it, as talk about that particular project or other particular specific projects that you've identified and are actually making happen right now.
Absolutely. So as I mentioned, we're working at local, state, and national and international scales. You know, locally, over half of the world's population and 82% of the U.S. population live in cities. And NASA estimates that 70% of global carbon dioxide emissions come from cities. So cities, though on an individual scale are small places, are incredibly important places for making a difference on this issue. And so one of the things that we've been doing is working with local leaders, working with in the Twin Cities region, the Metropolitan Council, a number of non-governmental organizations to really look at how we can help support cities to do more in ways that work for them economically. We're also working at a state level, some of these utility issues that we've been talking about and renewable energy issues that we've been talking about. And then I haven't mentioned on a more global level, we're doing a project on the Arctic. The Arctic is estimated to have 13% of the world's remaining oil and 30% of its natural gas, and 80% of that is offshore. And as climate change has made the Arctic more accessible, though it's still a very harsh environment, these questions around offshore drilling have become really important. And the U.S. is becoming chair of the Arctic Council in 2015, making these particularly sort of present issues. And so we're really trying to help synthesize this explosion of discussion and information that's going on around, you know, by government entities, by indigenous entities, by corporate trade organizations and standard-setting organizations to try to think about how one makes sure if this goes forward, it goes forward safely. We're also talking to local communities in Alaska. As you may know, the state of Alaska doesn't have a law school, and so there's often a great need there for legal help. We're in conversation with cities there about potentially helping them on renewable energy projects. A lot of cities with big sort of indigenous populations are off the grid, relying on diesel, and energy is hugely expensive there. So people are leaving these communities because they can't afford energy. And so there's a real opportunity through renewable energy to make energy more affordable, another one of these win-wins we were talking about earlier.
To bring it really down to the local level here, have you ever heard of the Cook County Local Energy Project?
It sounds familiar to me. Tell me a little more.
You'll have to learn a little bit about it, because it's a good example, I think, of acting locally, as you describe in one of your list items here. It's a group of individuals, and they're not necessarily millennials. You identify millennials as be ones that really identify the need to get rid of our dependence on fossil fuels, but these folks are more like boomer ages, and they've organized a nonprofit and are going to the local governments and trying to get focus on energy conservation. And I'm sure they would identify very well with your lab and the projects you're doing on a much larger scale.
And they also got a grant, I think, from the Clean Energy Resource Schemes as well.
They did, exactly. Yeah, so that might be a good example of what a small town can do to meet some of the goals that you've set here.
Absolutely. In fact, a lot of my work over the last several years has been looking at small towns, because Small towns are often places where a few committed individuals can make a massive difference in helping with energy transition. And I should mention, I mean, we would love to explore opportunities to partner with people in your community. So, you know, to the extent that there's an interest in developing projects with us there.
I wanted to give you an opportunity to tell our listeners where they can learn more about the Energy Transition Lab. Online.
Well, our website's actually about to launch. We're brand new, and so we should have it up by the end of the month. So we're so new that we're not quite on the web, but we'll be shortly.
Well, the University of Minnesota does have, in the Institute on Environment, has a page or two on it anyway. That will
right, and we're eventually going to have a freestanding website. That's
sure.
That's right, and yeah, I guess we could give them that web address. For now. So that's environment.umn.edu.
Right. And then you just look for Energy Transition Lab.
Right. Exactly. But we're about to have a full freestanding website for the lab. So stay tuned. And as I said, we really, for those listening to this program, we really welcome opportunities to collaborate on energy transition, and you know, our goal is to become a sort of a go-to place for people who are, you know, working on, you know, these sort of hard problems of how do we constructively move things forward, and would like some research help or some convening help, et cetera.
One question that I wanted to ask, and I know this could lead into such a long answer, but how does population growth factor into transitioning prospects, and are you hopeful for the future, or is it going to be a rough road?
These are two big and good questions. Population growth impacts the energy system in a whole variety of ways. Obviously, the greater the population is, the more strain there is on the energy system. But also, as population grows in countries that are transitioning to more energy-intensive uses, you know, there are all sorts of issues. I mean, so, for example, this is the big dilemma around China and climate change is their per capita, you know, each individual person is using less energy in China. But as people use more energy in China, if everybody in China used as much energy as everybody in the United States, it would be an enormous greenhouse gas footprint. So that's part of the dilemma. In terms of whether I'm an optimist, I'm an optimist. I like to be a realistic optimist, which is that I think even though we have a lot of incredibly challenging problems, and we've talked about a few of them today, I think that there are real opportunities to make a difference. And I think there are opportunities for all of us individually to make a difference in our communities on moving this forward, and that are all taking these actions, and these actions happening at multiple levels can really make a big difference.
I think everybody is aware of this issue and can identify with it, has a part in it, and that makes me hopeful too, that everybody realizes something has to be done, and people like you we rely on and appreciate the work you do and the Energy Transition Lab's work. And thank you so much for educating us a little more on what it is you do and what you think about the future.
Well, thank you so much for giving us the opportunity to be part of this program and to talk with you. It's been a real pleasure.